Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Hey team, welcome back to another episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. Today I'm really excited to be sitting down with Dr. David Conversar, who is a board certified cardiac anesthesiologist and intensivist and runs Count Backwards from 10, which makes anesthesia lessons that don't put you to sleep. So Dr. David, thank you so much for jumping on today. Do you want to introduce a little bit more about yourself? Because I only gave you a slight introduction and you know, there's lots more to hear.
I wish there was more to me, but it's mostly what I do is cardiac ICU, cardiac anesthesia. So I'm from New Jersey over in, the States. I grew up there. I did my undergraduate at the University of Pittsburgh, a medical school at Rutgers, and then came up to Boston to do my ICU fellowships and cardiac fellowships. And now I split my time mostly doing ICU and open heart and cardiac, and then I do liver transplants and mechanical circulatory support, so ECMO devices, Impella's balloons, those kinds of things.
That's absolutely insane. That's a lot, and that's fantastic. And I'm really keen to obviously be talking to you today about what we're going to go into, which it will be eventually cardiogenic shock. But before we get there, I wanted to go through with you some of the terms that obviously everyone's pretty familiar with, which is blood pressure, mean arterial pressure, things like cardiac output and preload and all those sorts of things, and try and provide a bit more of a pathophysiology behind it or a reason behind what we're interpreting and how that sort of makes a clinical or how we can apply that clinically. So I want to just start off with you with blood pressure. And I mean, it's something that we all know, but what is blood pressure in particular? And then also sort of these things that we hear about, like the Frank-Starling curve and things like that. How does this all play a role in blood pressure and how we sort of interpret it clinically?
Yeah. So the first thing about blood pressure is that people talk about blood pressure. And obviously there's a lot of words that we all kind of reflexively tell. Oh yeah, blood pressure is like the amount of pressure exerted by the heart and systole or diastole, whatever it may be. So blood pressure is, it comes obviously in three flavors, systolic, diastolic, and MAP. And in general, the systolic pressure, I always think about this as like a Tom and Jerry cartoon, where if you step on a hose and you see that big water wave coming through the hose that propagates down it, the systolic pressure is the pressure in that wave that is, the bubble. And your diastolic pressure is the pressure that's sitting in the non-big waved part of the tubing. And so the systolic pressure in our vasculature is the pressure, the max pressure that's generated by that wave propagated when the heart squeezes. The diastolic pressure is the lowest pressure, and that's basically a static pressure of blood sitting just in the tubing that is our vessels. And then our MAP is obviously kind of the average systolic plus two-thirds diastolic over that time. Now, we talk about blood pressure in medicine primarily because it's easy to study, but it's because it's a macro representation of the perfusion going on at a microscopic level. And so I don't want to say misconception, but something that people need to realize, that the reason we measure blood pressure is that we can't see the oxygen exchange in real time of what's going on at a micro level. And that's why, for example, patients who are in shock that got a whole ton of pressors to get their blood pressure up, their fingers and toes all start to turn black, because even though our blood pressure looks good, we've actually closed off everything, squeezed everything at a very small level so tightly that we're not getting any perfusion. And so, well, it's not a perfect system, it is the best macro way of determining, as a surrogate, how much flow we're getting to tissue.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, we've got, like, you talk about MAP, and I feel like MAP, I feel like it's a little bit overlooked in pre-hospital practice. And I mean, it's not something that I was necessarily taught a lot about at uni, other than, like you said, it's a systolic blood pressure plus 2/3 of your diastolic. I mean, what is a good range? And I guess, what does it reflect per se? And what, I guess, is that clinical implication? I mean, when we're looking at MAP, when is it important to consider, and how does it influence what we do?
Yeah, so a lot of these are important, not for any real reason, but because they've been studied, and that is a number that people have studied and cut off. And I can tell you that there are people that are older, that are 90 years old, that have very wide pulse pressures, that have a diastolic of 40 and a systolic of 120. They live with a lower MAP. So MAP, you can think of as your average, is just kind of the average perfused pressure between your systolic and diastolic. The easiest way to think about this is, you get some amounts of perfusion during systole to your organs and some amounts during diastole, and this is just the average of those two. And we just happen to study them and find that at certain cutoffs, mainly 65 in shock tends to be where we, you know, say, okay, outcomes are worse below that. Paper came out, I think, 2 years ago now, basically asking, is 60 the new 65 in shock, basically asserting that outcomes were no different with ongoing MAPs of 60 versus 65. And I'm sure in certain patient populations, like profound liver failure that people walk around with for years at a time, they might walk around and perfuse their organs at 50. And it's interesting because there is a curve for a number of organs, kidneys, brain especially, called, can't remember the name offhand, but it's basically the idea that as you walk around with chronic high blood pressure, your brain gets used to having a higher blood pressure. And therefore, if you acutely drop that blood pressure, patients get altered. Same thing happens to your kidneys. If you're 100 and walk around with a blood pressure of 190, and you, let's say, have an aortic dissection, and we acutely need to drop your pressure to 100, kidneys in those patients really don't like that. And so the point that I'm making is, there's probably a subset of people who actually walk around with very low blood pressures, and their curves have, as a result, adjusted over time. But for the average person, more or less, 60, 65 is usually where we are.
Awesome. That makes a lot of sense now. And so obviously, like, blood pressure, the equation is cardiac output multiplied by your systemic vascular resistance. To break down these terms even further before we go anywhere, what is systemic vascular resistance for those of our listeners that don't know what that is, and sort of what influences that side of things?
Yeah. And before saying this, I think just to anybody who's listening, is I think it's a lot easier. I feel as though when I was in school, I was pigeonholed into memorizing things. But if I asked you what the resistance to something was outside of medicine, you'd probably be able to give me a pretty good answer, because you're not thinking about something you had to memorize. And so I do encourage everybody to think about things like that. And so the systemic vascular resistance is exactly what it sounds like. It is the resistance in the systemic vascular system. It's your arterial system and how narrow it is. Because you can imagine, as a tube narrows, there is more resistance to flow. Flow is equal to delta P over resistance, which then you can move over to make resistance equal to delta P over flow. And so, but in conceptual terms, you can imagine that a more narrow or more tightly squeezed blood vessel will have basically more friction, more resistance to flow. And so SVR is just how hard it is to flow forward, how much resistance there is to that forward flow. And then cardiac output, again, cardiac and output is just the number of liters per minute that your heart is pumping out every time your heart beats.
Awesome. And I guess cardiac output, when we see that drop, or when we think it's dropped, we obviously think of things like, decreased levels of mentation or low levels of urine output, things like that. So cardiac output, it's obviously related to things like, or our equation for that, I guess, is cardiac output equals, you know, your heart rate multiplied by your stroke volume. And as you said, it's the amount in liters that's going around. What do you think in terms of, if you want to go into a little bit more about like cardiac output in the sense of things like stroke volume, because that's influenced by the three things that we all hear about, which is contractility, preload and afterload. I feel like those are important topics, particularly when we're moving into things like cardiogenic shock. If you want to just briefly go over those for us.
Sure. So I will firstly say that cardiac output is largely useless in like a general sense. It's not completely useless, but cardiac index is much better. And anytime people hear the phrase something is indexed, what that means is they've divided by the body surface area of the patient, the size of the patient, essentially. And the reason it's done is that everyone at some point at university or wherever it is has been told a normal cardiac output is 4 to 6 liters a minute. I'm like, oh, okay, that doesn't make any sense because Andre the Giant was almost 8 feet tall and like 500 pounds. And then I've had patients that are these little old ladies that are, you know, 50 kilos. And you're like, there's no way that those two have a normal cardiac output of 4 to 6 liters a minute. And so by indexing it, you divide it by the patient's body surface area and it basically normalizes it to a smaller scale. And in general, cardiac index 2.2 and below is considered cardiogenic shock. Normal is 2.5, 2.6 and higher. And so that's probably a better metric. But back to the question about cardiac output, the question is, you know, what is your body trying to do? It always comes back to that. Your body is trying to maintain perfusion to organs. And the best way to do that is to pump blood out to said organs as efficiently as possible. And so the way, if you, like you mentioned, your output, cardiac output is equal to heart rate and stroke volume. And so one can conceptualize that if one of those things goes down, if you drop your stroke volume, like we do with every breath that we take, then your body reacts and says, oh crap, blood pressure is going down, perfusion is going down, we need to augment it, beat faster, right? And that's primarily, you know, that's the, you know, more obvious reason in hypovolemia, trauma, hemorrhage, things like that. When your blood pressure drops because your stroke volume has dropped, your heart rate dramatically increases to try and improve perfusion. And this becomes extremely relevant in like cardiac physiology, cardiac cases, coronary artery disease, valve disease, et cetera. Kind of on a very big circle. But the point is that afterload, preload, and heart rate affect these in that the more blood you fill the left ventricle with, the more it will stretch. And this is what you were asking about the Frank Starling curve before. And the more it stretches, the more the heart is able to recoil because the heart is naturally elastic. So more stretch, more recoil, just like a rubber band, you will eject more blood. Secondly, if your heart works well, because remember, it's still a muscle, the muscles still have to contract actively. So the more contractility you have, the harder the heart squeezes innately, the more blood will be ejected. And the higher your heart rate, just like when you exercise, because your body is trying to get more oxygen to end organs that are using a bunch of it, the more blood is ejected per minute. And so those are really our three determinants of kind of your output. At the same time, they're also the determinants of myocardial oxygen demand. The more blood your heart has to output, the more oxygen it takes to do that, just like any pump, any muscle, anything.
Absolutely. That makes a lot of sense. And I mean, that's the best way, I guess, it's ever been explained to me. And it's funny because I've never actually heard of cardiac index until I think yourself and a couple other videos I've watched talk about it. And it's not been something that was taught at uni in regards to thinking about sort of shock. And so it's really fascinating that, so what's the equation is there an equation for that when you're just on run, you really quickly need to figure it out? Or
it's just cardiac output over body surface area, but body surface area has a bit more of an equation to figure out. So, you know, usually we're using this index most of the times is, patients come into the hospital, they have a body surface area. It's based off of their height in centimeters, their weight in kilos, divided by 3,600, the square root of that value. Anyway, the point is you divide their output by their index, and that gives you an index. Their BSA, cardiac output over BSA gives you cardiac index. And so same thing happens with like valve areas. You know, we talk about how big the aortic valve annulus is, the tricuspid valve annulus is. Well, you and I have very different sized hearts, but when you index it at certain cutoffs, you're like, wow, that's a really big annulus, and maybe that's the cause of like a regurgitation or something. So indexing is a very powerful tool to help normalize across various sized people.
That's really fascinating. I mean, it makes sense, really, at the end of the day, because no one is really the same in terms of their numbers, really. So jumping into shock then, we always hear about shock. You know, the main ones we see in pre-hospital, like hypovolemic shock or distributive shock, things like that. I feel like we're going to go into cardiogenic shock, which I feel like is sort of, I guess, a little bit forgotten in the sense, or doesn't really get too looked into too much, really, from what I've experienced and from at uni and on road. But we'll jump into shock first. What is shock? What are the clinical sides of it? And I mean, from your understanding, I mean, when someone's going to tell you that they've got a patient in shock, what are you looking for?
Yeah, so I can't tell you how many people, med students, residents, even fellows of OGS, like, what is shock? And everyone tells you the same thing. It's malperfusion or hypoperfusion of end organs. And that's not true. The problem in shock is a lack of oxygen at end organs or hypoxia at end organs. And the way you can identify that is, well, what if you had a patient that was bleeding to death and I gave them 12 liters of crystalloid back and you stopped the bleeding? And so now their hemoglobin is 1 and their circulating blood volume is mostly crystalloid. Is that person still going to be in shock even though they have a normal blood pressure? It's like, absolutely they are, because they do not have enough oxygen tension and enough hemoglobin carrying capacity to get oxygen to end organs. So the definition is end organ hypoxia, and then due to whatever the cause is, whatever results in lack of perfusion. It could be lack of total blood pressure. You simply do not have enough volume in the tank to pump out. It could be you have an obstruction that prevents filling. So if you have a massive pulmonary embolus, for example, and your right heart can't get blood to your left heart because there's a big blockage in the way, you can't pump blood out to the body. If you are septic or distributive or neurogenic or allergic reaction, basically all of your blood vessels super dilate. And so now, because they're dilated, you have no perfusion because there's no pressure to perfuse anything with. So, but at the end of the day, the problem is not the lack of perfusion. It's the lack of oxygen transport to those tissues. Because remember, oxygen is the, last kind of electron acceptor in the oxidative pathway for metabolism, and then you undergo anaerobic metabolism. So shock is the lack of oxygen to end organs. And so to that effect, when I ask people about, like, I get an ICU call, oh, this patient's in shock. Oh, why? Well, their blood pressure is low and their heart rate is high and, their white count is up. And okay, those are all things that happen. Yeah, okay, but why do you think they're in shock? And, they basically keep telling you the same thing. Not everyone does it, but if I asked you as a young, healthy woman that you get a stomach bug at home and you're vomiting for days and you have a fever and you're having trouble keeping down Gatorade, and I asked you, somebody about you, this patient, do you think that you have a white count? Absolutely. You're sick. You're just not in the hospital measuring it. Is your blood pressure low? 100%. You just are at home and not measuring your blood pressure. But none of those things require you to be in the ICU on vasopressors, right? And so usually we're looking at it as a refractory response to volume or to whatever it is that they need to compensate for what they've lost, right? And so that tends to be what shock is. And in looking at signs, you're really looking at signs of end organ dysfunction that are not getting better with treatment. That ends up being the problem. If you're septic, you're super vasodilated, you're not perfusing your kidneys, the patient will not make urine, their creatinine will rise. If they're not getting blood and oxygen to their brain, they will become altered, they will become, unconscious. You don't get it to your lungs, just like a pulmonary embolus, you will breathe faster, you will have infarcts in your lung possibly. The most common presenting symptom for shock in patients from a cardiac standpoint, aside from tachycardia, is general T-wave inversions, because you have ischemia to the heart. So when I want to hear about when you think a patient is in shock, sure, the need for pressor is one thing, but you can come off pressor with appropriate resuscitation or whatever it is the patient needs. I want to know whether or not they are perfusing their end organs. And you can have somebody who, remember, patients who are in shock go on pressor and they still are in shock. Like, they're still not perfusing their end organs because that's not necessarily the problem. And that's why their fingers and toes fall off, because there's not oxygen going to those kind of those places. Anyway, to summate all of that, lack of oxygen at end organs for reason X, Y, or Z, non-responsive to standard treatments, which is usually volume.
That's a really great way. I think it's a fantastic summary and really makes it clear, because I feel like I've been on the phone before to a resus consultant just before I'm about to bring a patient in who I'm worried about that they're in shock, and they'll say, what makes you think that they're in shock, or something like that. And I've been that person that said, oh, you know, increased rest rate, or, you know, low blood pressure and things like that. But having a full understanding of this now, being like, okay, well, they're altered GCS, they're, you know, they're confused, which is new for them, and all these different things. I mean, it makes a lot more sense when trying to, I guess, sell the story of the patient.
100%. That's what you want to know. And it's also why we ask it, because you give volume back. Or what do you think the problem is? If you gave them volume and it's not helping, the reason is that, you know, despite volume, they're still not getting oxygen to where it needs to be.
Awesome. That makes a lot of sense. And I really, really think that's a fantastic way to go into cardiogenic shock. So as mentioned at the start, cardiogenic shock, I feel like gets missed quite a bit. And I've been the person that's missed it before, you know, even recently. And it wasn't until a reflection that I realized, actually, this person was probably in cardiogenic shock. What is cardiogenic shock? I feel like, you know, everything we've talked about leads to this now. But what is it? What causes it? I think would be good to start off with as well.
Yeah. So as you can imagine, shock, you're not getting oxygen to your end organs. And in this case, it's because your heart is simply not able to pump blood to said organs, right? Either the right side of your heart cannot get blood to the left side of your heart to eject, or your left side of your heart simply cannot eject itself. And so, I'm sorry, you said, what is it? So that's the first thing it is. And then what was the second half of the question? I apologize.
No, you're fine. Causes. So what can cause this?
Yeah. So causes, cardiogenic shock is the result of essentially the heart not ejecting. And that may be because you have diastolic heart dysfunction. The heart cannot fill enough to actually eject enough blood, or it simply cannot squeeze hard enough to eject blood. And so anything that causes one of those two things, and again, the reason I ask people or encourage people to think about things in their basis forms is that if I asked a college student or somebody that's never taken a medical course ever, and I was like, what, give me one reason you think a patient might be in cardiogenic shock, or rather than phrasing it like that, give me one reason you think your heart might not pump blood appropriately to your organs, they will say, well, the patient probably had a heart attack. It's like, yeah, okay, so you have a big infarct. There is dying heart tissue and it can't eject very well. What else? Well, maybe there's a big afterload issue. So patients who have severe aortic stenosis and are now decompensated for one reason or another. The heart is beating too fast and they can't eject blood through that valve. Inability to fill the heart appropriately because the LV is so thick over time that they get a little hypovolemic and all of a sudden they can't fill the heart. So causes primarily are just anything you think that would result in your heart decreasing its ejection. Now, that being said, obstructive shock, while not technically cardiogenic shock, kind of falls in a similar area in that if you have a big pulmonary embolus, your heart can't generate forward flow, but it's because there's a physical obstruction within the heart. If you have a pneumothorax and you collapse a whole bunch of alveoli, you collapse a whole bunch of pulmonary vasculature, and now your right heart can't pump to your left. Point being is, in general, it's when one of the ventricles of your heart is not ejecting blood appropriately.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And really, yeah, like you said, if you think of anything that impacts, you know, your heart's ability to pump or push blood forward, or, you know, you're going to get a long list of things. So I feel like that makes a lot of sense. Now, what are some of the, I guess, clinical manifestations of that? You know, we've talked about some in terms of shock, but what would be sort of the list of clinical implications that you'd see on a history or a physical exam?
Yeah. So this is really, really important to anybody listening, because the reason is that we treat shock empirically by giving volume, because you're like, patient has low blood pressure, they call it volume, whatever it is, but giving blood volume or giving, you know, crystalloid, whatever it may be, to a patient in cardiogenic shock, if it's not a filling issue, will make things infinitely worse. And this happens a lot of times, because you can imagine kind of like a pair of, let's say, elastic waistband pants. It stretches to a point where it does not recoil anymore, right? And that's what we do when we overfill patients' hearts with blood volume, and now all of a sudden they cannot have that nice spring contractility. So you need to be aware of these things. So I think the very first thing is you feel their hands and feet, because those are the most kind of distal places that the heart needs to pump blood to. And if the heart is weak enough, hands and feet will be cold. That's when we go into evaluate patients, either in the ICU or the OR, or just our general patients, that you're determining differences in shock. You know, anyone that's distributive, so if they're septic, if they have neurogenic cause, whatever it is, they will have warm skin, right? Because they dilate their vessels everywhere. And so that increases flow. But oppositely, cardiogenic shock will decrease flow to the hands, decrease flow to the feet. Everything gets cold. And that's the first thing I want to know. That's my first hint. Now, if their whole body's cold because they've been exposed or whatever, different story. But if I go to someone's house and they're found down or whatever, their hands and feet are ice cold, that's my first hint. Secondly is pulse pressure. And this is something that I think is lost on a lot of people from a conceptual point, is the pulse pressure is the difference between your systolic and your diastolic pressure. So you think of a normal person, 120 over 80. So to be clear, and this may be, some people may say, yeah, I know this, but other people may say, thank you for explaining that. I would be embarrassed to ask. What makes the aortic valve open? Why does blood actually leave the heart? Well, a normal left atrial and left ventricular pressure is like 8 to 12. It's very low, because the pressure in the atrium, when the valve opens, fills the left ventricle. And the ventricular pressure has to be lower than that in order for the valve to open. Everything is a pressure gradient. And so when blood needs to leave the left ventricle into the aorta, remember you have the aortic valve. The reason the aortic valve is closed is that the pressure on the aortic side of the valve is higher at, let's say, 80 in a normal person, 120 over 80. That diastolic pressure is 80, and the diastolic pressure in the left ventricle is 7. So the valve will not open because the pressure is greater on the other side. It would be like if you and I were standing at a door, I was pushing on the door with 70 millimeters of mercury, you were pushing with 3, the door's not going to open towards me. But you get a whole bunch of your friends and you all push the door at once, which is what systole is, the valve or the door opens. And so in order for your aortic valve to open, your heart has to generate a pressure that's higher than your diastolic pressure in the aorta. So pressure in the aorta, 120 over 80, systolic pressure has to be greater, right? Normal person has a delta between those two of 40 points. Your heart is generating a pressure of 120, 130, whatever it is. And your diastolic in the aorta is 80, which means that if you have cardiogenic problems, that difference between the two will drop dramatically, usually like borderline 20, maybe 25 points. And that's another hint. If I get a cuff pressure, although invasive is obviously much better because cuffs are back calculated, that tells me that I have a lack of pulse pressure generation from my ventricle, and that the ventricle may be weak and cardiogenic. If I walk into a room and the delta between the two is 70, I'm like, this is not cardiogenic. The heart is able to generate a massive amount of pressure. So that's two. Three, pulses. You know, patients in septic shock, obviously, everyone gets low pulses just for low perfusion, but you want to check to make sure they have them. And then the cause of whatever it may be. Bedside echo is probably the strongest tool nowadays as they're becoming more and more available. you know, companies like Butterfly and Philips with the Lumify and other things that allow us to go to the bedside and put a probe on and say, yeah, the heart's not moving very well. And then one other one that's, I think, left out, and again, I probably should have mentioned before, is sometimes you have patients with like AFib with RVR. Their heart rate's going 150 times a minute, and they're in AFib. So there's no synchronized filling of the LV. You can get a type of kind of cardiogenic shock in that sense because you don't fill the left ventricle appropriately. It's not an obstruction, although it kind of is, but really you're just not synchronizing your atrial filling to your ventricle. The ventricle's filling, ejecting too fast. There's not enough time for passive filling. And you can go into cardiogenic shock that way because there is simply not enough stroke volume with every beat to get blood out. But I digress. The main two things I'm looking at on physical exam that are not a bedside echo are their hands and feet cold? What's their pulse pressure? And then obviously the story, right? If I know that the patient has a history of coronary artery disease and they're 70 years old, they had stents, you know, a couple of years back with angioplasty or, constant smoker, whatever it may be, those all kind of lend to the idea that this may be a heart issue. And that excludes like EKG changes, things like that.
What then would you do for treatment? I mean, in pre-hospital environment, we're pretty stuck in terms of what we can do. Obviously, you've got a lot more opportunity to give presses and things like that in hospital. But I feel like it's still good to know from a pre-hospital understanding what happens to the patient at hospital, just so that we can either start to prepare that sort of thing, getting the patient to where they need to go, that sort of stuff. And I feel like having that understanding what that journey looks like for the patient really does help.
Yep. So in general, you need inotropic support. Now, it depends on the cause, but a lot of times, especially in patients with decompensated heart failure over time, whatever it may be, they need the heart to squeeze better. And so supporting that muscle with dobutamine, and usually dobutamine or epi, usually patients acutely hypotensive. Milrinone is not a great choice because of its effects on dropping blood pressure, but in general, you need to help the heart squeeze better. So epi infusions tend to be very potent. Now, we do need to recognize that there's always a risk of making the cause worse. If somebody is having, let's say, cardiogenic shock secondary to a myocardial infarction, the heart needs a lot of blood, needs a lot of oxygen. It's not getting that because, you know, part of it is dying. And now you say, okay, we need you to work harder. The heart doesn't love that. But the only way to augment your output is to make it work harder, whip the heart, as we say. The other thing is we need to, very importantly, not give these patients fluids a lot of times. Because as the heart continues to fill, it does not eject very well. And so this comes back to your Frank Starling curve, is that on the x-axis, it's harder when you're listening rather than watching, to anybody who's listening, but on your x-axis, you have your preload, or the amount of volume going into the heart. On your y-axis, you have cardiac output, or stroke volume, whatever you want to call it. And the idea is that as you fill the heart, you get kind of like this arc formed with the relationship where the more filling, the more ejection you get. And you get it up until an asymptotic point where it almost flattens off and diminishing returns, where you get more volume back, but you don't actually get more ejection. And then at some point, you steeply, people say the phrase fall off the curve, with the implication that you've stretched the heart so much because you've given too much volume that it cannot eject, that basically your ejection just drops because the heart is stretched beyond ability to recoil, right? And so now it's just dilated and dead, not working. And so treatment focuses on making the heart eject more. If you can, making the afterload slightly lower so it's easier for the heart to eject, So not using phenylephrine, for example, because phenylephrine has I'm sure that there's papers someone would say, oh, it doesn't matter. And maybe that's true. I couldn't tell you. But if you increase LV afterload by squeezing the vasculature and then slow down the heart rate, which is an innate function of phenylephrine, well, your heart now has zero ability to eject, right? Because cardiac output is heart rate and stroke volume. Your heart rate has dropped. Your stroke volume has now dramatically gone down because your afterload is higher. So it's harder for your heart to push against. All those things are bad. So inotropic support and not giving volume tend to be the number one things that when patients get to us, I guarantee you most of the time we check their CVPs. You know, we do an echo and we're like, the heart's not moving great. The CVP is 20, you know, and people like to say, people love saying, because someone has regurgitated to them at some point, CVP is not a good metric of volume status. And that's true for like septic patients and some other things when you're in a middle ground state. But when your CVP is 0 to 2 or above 15 or 16, it is very telling. No one's CVP should be 15. Yours standing up right now is 0 because it's all draining into your heart normally. And so at the two extremes, it is quite telling. And if a patient rolls in with a CVP truly of 15, 20, and we suspect cardiogenic shock and it's consistent with the echo, like, not good. So you need to get volume off of them dramatically, you diurese the crap out of them to get volume out of that chamber so that you decrease the filling and you allow the heart to appropriately contract and eject. So inotropic support, decreased volume, really what you're going for. And so you can imagine that in patients where if they're in shock and you're worried about that from cardiogenic source, it needs to be ruled in or out relatively quickly because everything else is basically treated with fluid. And if you give fluid to these people, they will get worse.
That's really interesting. Because I mean, in a pre-hospital setting, we usually think like, you know, treat symptomatically, i.e., you know, generally if they're, you know, got a low blood pressure or not perfusing well, we'll generally pop on, you know, some fluids. And so I feel like that's really interesting. So I guess, yeah, being very careful in that sense, now knowing that information is probably a really good thing going forward.
They're super quick. They're super easy to recognize. Like, listen, guys, hands and feet are cold. The patient has a history of CAD that we're aware of, you know, and his pulse pressure is super narrow. And like, you know, that's why we emphasize looking at JVD on physical exam. A JVD in this case would also lead me towards cardiogenic shock. He's like, there is no drainage of blood from the right side of the heart. Now, it could be other things that also need to be considered, right? If you have tamponade, which causes a very similar picture to cardiogenic shock, for example, tamponade, you need fluid. It's like the number one thing is you need to open fluids wide open. But tamponade will cause almost the exact same picture as a cardiogenic shock because you are not filling the left side of the heart to then eject blood to the body. Hands and feet will be cold, pulse pressure will drop. But if you treat them the wrong way, that person is in trouble as well. So you need to have some thoughtful discussion. Yeah, bolusing 250 is never going to be the end of the world, even in somebody with some shock, while you decide on what you're going to do. Giving a liter is very different. And giving a liter is very important in tamponade, because you need to keep the heart full and the intracardiac pressure is high enough to overcome the pericardial pressure from the fluid. But giving it to a patient with just ventricular failure will make everything back up. You'll get congestive hepatopathy, nephropathy, the heart won't eject, and it's a disaster. So a little fluid while you're thinking and temporizing and getting your wits about. But I think it's important for everyone. That's why even during codes or ROST or whatever it is, everyone stops at some point and says, okay, here's what happened. Here's what our differential for what's going on. Here's what we've done. What are people thinking? Do we think that this is X? Do we think this is Y? And we need to decide on which kind of decision tree to take. And so I think I've never been a pre-hospitalist. I do not know kind of the stress that goes on when you're out in the field, you don't have resources, you don't have somebody to call, it's just you guys. And so I can't imagine what that's like. But with practice comes the idea of being able to say, we've gotten to a point where we've done a couple of things, right? We think we know what it is, and then look at that tree. Do we need more fluid? Should we stop fluid and start something else? But use that as like a, if it were me, I would use that as a moment to kind of stop and slow things down. People are like, they think if things go slow, something bad will happen. But that's not necessarily true, especially the patient still has a pulse. Not slow, but in a thoughtful way, because going fast and messing it up will be devastatingly worse.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you can get so overwhelmed that your cognitive bandwidth can get really narrow. So just taking that moment, having a breath, and just talking to your peers, whoever may be with you, just to discuss that might help just give you a moment and give you the ability to widen your cognitive bandwidth that you may have been so task focused on doing something for so long that you can just then take a minute and actually focus on what's next. I think that's been a fantastic overview of cardiogenic shock and all of, you know, our cardiac sort of terms, like our blood pressure and our MAP and everything like that. Is there anything that you think we've missed that you think would be really important to let everyone know?
Yeah, there's nothing in particular. The world of cardiogenic shock and heart failure is so complex that, you know, I'm an intensivist and, you know, cardiac anesthesiologist, and I ran in a very, very large cardiac ICU. And we still round with the heart failure cardiologists. And there's, you know, very interesting back and forth and discussion about management of these things. And so it's important to recognize that we can oversimplify things for the sake of, you know, expediency or something needs to be done immediately, which is completely reasonable. But everyone needs to realize that it is a very complex, you know, issue. Things involving ventricular function in and of itself, ventricular geometry. So how the ventricles affect one another based off of how they're squeezing, how they're filled, how they're working. I mean, for example, if you have right heart failure, which is not uncommon after a heart transplant or something immediately post-op because the heart has been ischemic, basically, you know, how we get the right heart to beat better is dependent on how we make the left heart beat. So super, super important. I think one thing that is overlooked, and this is not necessarily cardiogenic shock, but I to anybody who's willing to listen, everyone probably has heard this equation at some point, the coronary perfusion equation, which is like a coronary perfusion pressure is equal to aortic diastolic pressure minus left ventricular end diastolic pressure. Maybe you've heard that, maybe you haven't. Maybe somebody has told you the LV only gets perfused during systole and the RV only gets perfused, you know, during the whole cardiac cycle. This illustrates a very good point that most things, especially why heart failure is interesting and why cardiogenic shock is interesting, is that it's a matter of getting blood to flow in the direction you want it to flow. And you can only do that by increasing a pressure gradient. If you imagine your aorta, and then your coronary arteries come off your aortic root and then travel along the ventricles of the heart, whatever pressure the ventricles generate will be transmitted to those coronary arteries, okay? And what that means is the differential between the aorta and the pressure in the coronary artery is what determines how much perfusion you get. And so during systole, the left ventricular squeezes and generates a pressure of 120, the aortic valve opens, the aorta now has a pressure of 120 because it's one contiguous space. So those pressures have to be equal, which means that during systole, the coronary artery is experiencing 120, you know, millimeters of mercury worth of pressure, and the aorta is 120. So the delta between the two of them is zero. So there's no flow. But during diastole, the left ventricle has a pressure of 6, 7, 8, and the aortic pressure is 80. And so you get left coronary perfusion during only diastole because the delta there is 75. If you look at the right side of the heart, a normal right ventricular systolic pressure is 25, and your aortic systolic pressure is 120. So you have a delta during systole, and during diastole, your diastolic pressure is 5. So you have a delta between the aorta and the right. So the right heart is perfused at all times during the cardiac cycle. The left heart is only diastole. And you can imagine that things that will help improve coronary perfusion is driving up your systolic pressures if it's indicated to help perfuse your heart. If you think the patient is having like a right-sided MI because you see inferior wall infarction on your EKG, one of the best things you can do is increase your coronary perfusion pressure to the right heart by trying to drive the systemic pressure up. And so again, the point of that is to illustrate the idea that most of cardiac, not electrophysiology, is a function of pressure gradients and how we optimize flow to places we want it to go. So it's just something to think about.
Absolutely. And I mean, I'm going to throw you a question that's going to be a little bit off track, but because you mentioned potentially like, you know, an inferior MI, there's always that question of nitrates or not having nitrates.
Yeah. The classic teaching is don't give nitrates. The data doesn't support that anymore. And there are lots of things I think that are, unfortunately, they evolve, right? People will do things and they will have anecdotal experience that we gave nitrates and this patient had an inferior and they died right away. It's like, okay, well, that's, you know, experience and that's terrible. I'm sorry. Then you have people will be like, the data does not support that nitrates cause a difference in myocardial, in worsening. The thought is that if you have an inferior wall MI and you have a right heart dysfunction, you are preload dependent to get flow to the other side of the heart because your right heart is not contracting well. And conceptually, you're like, yeah, that makes sense. The evidence has not borne it out. That being said, once upon a time, we used to think that swans didn't help outcomes in heart failure in the ICU, and the data has since changed. Now, I do believe in practicing evidence-based medicine, and that if the evidence does not support, now I don't know if it's non-inferiority studies, I don't know if it's, people have a very, this is not meant to criticize anybody. We have a very bad problem nowadays in what I call clickbait medicine, is where people follow Instagrammers, they follow YouTubers, they follow whatever, even abstracts and papers, and they will read the conclusion or they'll read the abstract and they'll be like, I know everything about this paper. I'm like, great. And then you regurgitate that some other time. Oh, we don't give bicarb to patients in the ICU because it doesn't change outcomes. It's like, well, that's not true all the time. Or you shouldn't intubate in X, Y, and Z. And the problem is the studies that bear these things out have a very specific patient population, right? Now, patients having inferior wall MIs is a very specific patient population. That may be the case. But the most important thing is reading the data so that you're not just, this age-old question may be, yeah, don't give nitrates in patients with inferior wall MIs who have like a known, reduced ejection fraction. Because if they already have it, you know, that may make it worse. I don't know offhand because I don't know the literature back and front for it. But I think the important thing is that if somebody tells you something like that, your job should be, okay, where did you hear this? Oh, a paper said it. Well, don't let people get off easy by being like, okay, fine, because most people have just regurgitated things that they've been told by somebody else instead of reading it for themselves. And you will find that people have said things that may be true in a very specific scenario, but are not overall correct. And so it's very important to go back and read the papers, how the studies were done. There's a patient paper, I won't get too much into it, but somebody basically said, don't intubate, don't give fluids with intubations. You know, like, you know, it doesn't change outcomes or not don't, but giving fluids. And it's like, that seems like an aggressive assertion. And then you go and you read the paper and almost 25% of the patients were excluded from this study because they were volume dependent or septic. And you're like, well, but you just made a very bold statement at the end of this paper saying that giving fluids did not change induction outcomes. Like, you didn't standardize how much induction agent you gave. Did you give propyrrhotamidate? How did you paralyze them? Like, What were your tidal volume? Like, there's a lot of confounding factors. And so that this is a very long way of saying the nitrates question, I do not know the correct answer to. I have been told, and I've read, you know, a couple of papers that says that it doesn't change anything, but it also depends on the metric and the outcome. If you're looking at the outcome being morbidity, mortality, that's one thing, because that may be a long 30-day mortality. Maybe those patients died in the ICU anyway. If you're looking at peri arrest after giving a nitrate, that's a very different outcome. So I encourage people to go and look at the paper, especially if somebody just says, oh, you know, there's a paper that came out of that. It's like, what paper? Tell me, because I can't know if what you're telling me is true if I don't go read. And there's a very big difference between data-driven medicine and things that are physiologically active. And so perfusion pressure of the coronary artery doesn't change because a study, you know, there's a study in this, but like outcome-driven data does. And so, and you need to establish what your outcome is. Again, giving nitrates might not change 30-day mortality in patients with inferior MIs, but it may change peri arrest of giving that drug or resuscitation or whatever. And that may be because patients with right heart failure or severe right heart MIs die anyway. Don't know.
Absolutely. And I mean, it brings up a fantastic point of just trying to understand information that you do read and being able to critically appraise research articles and things like that. I mean, this is something it's really important.
It's very hard. I think it's very underrated as a skill. If you ever read the New England Journal or any big journals, Chest, whatever it is, there's entire letters to the editor section where people go after reading these and a week or two later write criticisms of the study, why this is bad, why this is not correct, what, you know, their thoughts on it. People say, oh, I read the paper. Well, it's like, I'm pretty good at reading papers. And it still takes me a while to sit and digest and make sure that I understand what was good about it, what was bad about it. I mean, Eddie Joe, who does a lot of Instagram stuff on papers, Eddie and I are good friends. I give him an enormous amount of credit because it takes a lot of time to sit and actually break down a paper and recognize what it's actually looking at, why the outcomes matter that they do, et cetera. And so talk about it with people. That's why Journal Club is so important. Is because Journal Club is a way of involving yourself in a study and understanding why it was good, why it was bad, the limitations, what population, all those kinds of things. I know we're kind of off topic at this point, but I think it's important. I think Journal Club, you know, people don't like to do it because it feels like work, but it's very, very helpful.
I feel like, you know, having an understanding of that if I was in my first year of uni would have made such a difference to how I used evidence throughout my entire degree and now as a new clinician. So I feel like it's actually really important. Whilst it might seem boring, it's actually incredibly important. So just to finalize, is there any, obviously you've got your Instagram pages, but do you want to outline to all of our listeners whereabouts they can find you and all your information?
Yeah, so my email is just, my Instagram one is anesthesiacbf10@gmail.com. The Instagram page is just count backwards from 10, the YouTube channel. I answer pretty much everyone that messages me, so if you have questions or concerns, please feel free to send me a message. If anyone's ever looking for me to talk to them or for their institution or whatever it is, I do give formal lectures. I don't charge for anything because I want people to know these things, so when they come rolling through the door, I'm not sitting there like, why did this patient get 4 liters of fluid? Because now it makes my job that much more difficult. But I really, like, as I get older, people, you know, have said at some point, well, you know, what would you want for your mother? And I really genuinely am at a stage in my career in my life, although early, where, like, I want to make sure that everybody is doing what's best for their patients, because if it was my mother or my father or my brother rolling in an ambulance or wherever it may be, I would want to make sure that this information is available and that people are doing the right things, because you want the best for those people. So please feel free to reach out at any time. I answer everybody. I'm always happy to get on the phone. Or if you guys, you know, want lectures at your programs, I'm always happy to talk kind of more in depth about some of these things.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. David. I really appreciate it. And I'll pop all of those links into the show notes so everyone can go and check out all of your awesome information. And I really appreciate you jumping on today.
No, it's my pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Student Paramedic Podcast. You can connect with us on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, or you can email us at thestudentparamedicpodcast@gmail.com.